Welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts with hosts Margaret Pickoff, Tom Butzler, Sandy Feather, and Tim Abbey.
Hello, welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast from Penn State Extension for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts. I'm one of your hosts, Margaret Pickoff. I'm a horticulture educator with Penn State Extension, and each episode I'm joined by my colleagues on the green industry team as co-hosts. On today's special episode, I'm happy to welcome Tom Butzler, Sandy Feather, and Tim Abbey for a discussion on what we're seeing around the state as of today, which is the last day of summer, September 22nd. So usually this is just a really small segment of our episode where we kind of quickly talk about what we've been seeing in the field. But this time we have the whole episode to talk about it. So who wants to go first? We're kind of all in different parts of the state. As a reminder, I am in southeastern Pennsylvania in the greater Philly, Bucks County area. Tom Butzler, you're in the central part of the state.
That's right.
Tim Abbey, you're in York County, which is kind of south central, a little bit more east than central.
It's considered south central, but I think of more like to the southeast, I guess.
Okay.
Not and quite as southeast as you, though.
Okay. Yeah. I'm right in the corner. And then Sandy Feather, you are in the Pittsburgh area, so western PA.
That's correct.
Sandy, maybe we'll get started with you because I know that Pittsburgh has been seeing a lot of spotted lanternfly this season. What's it been like out there?
You know, where they're bad, they're bad. You know, people are up in arms. You know, I had to run out to the Pittsburgh Botanic Garden yesterday, and from my office to the Botanic Garden, you have to go through downtown Pittsburgh. And they were flying into my windshield. They, you know, I could see people stomping them on the sidewalks. So, you know, in downtown Pittsburgh and on the north side, they're really bad and just different. It's interesting to me because it's like where I live, knock on wood, they're not so bad. And a few blocks down the hill from me, they're terrible. They're right. But there's railroad tracks there and the Allegheny River. And I don't know if that, you know, allowed their population to kind of grow in that part of Verona or not. But so lots of questions, both from like homeowners who are kind of up in arms, and then a woman who runs an urban farm and has created this really nice niche market for herself by growing organic produce and then having local celebrity chefs come in and prepare these really exquisite meals. And unfortunately, there were black walnut trees growing near the dining area for her guests. And she made the really tough decision to cut those trees down because the spotted lanternflies were really making a mess at her dinners.
That's unfortunate. I when an invasive comes into the area, you know, understandably, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions and, you know, people kind of get a little worried, maybe sometimes over the top. But, you know, Penn State, some of the researchers have come out the past several weeks and saying that, you know, this might not be as bad as we originally thought. You know, there's not any tree death or mortality. Maybe the biggest concern is just on grapevines. Other than that, everything else is going to be more of a nuisance, you know, trees underneath where you have that, you know, sticky substance falling and so forth. But, you know, contrast that to years ago, the emerald ash borer, which ran through Pennsylvania. And yes, there was a lot of tree mortality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah. And that was, I was really happy to hear that research come out because I think it soothes a lot of people about the ornamental and shade trees in their yards. That was a unique situation that she had because these trees were overhanging the dining area for her guests, and the insects themselves, not to mention the honeydew, was just really making that a difficult thing.
And that's really hard too, because I know what we experienced, well, I wasn't living in Philly yet at the time that the spotted lanternfly was really, really bad. But what we've experienced across the eastern part of the state is there will be a summer that they're really terrible. And then the next year they might, as you said, there's little pockets of high population density, and we don't really understand what causes them to move to different areas, or you know, what those dynamics are like. And so to make long-term decisions based on the population for this summer, that is a really tough call, because we don't know how to predict. I mean, they could be not even a problem next summer, but for someone whose, you know, livelihood depends on having a pleasant outdoor space, that's really, really hard.
And I know it was a tough decision for her to make. And I actually talked to her. I talked to the arborist that she was working with. He's a really nice guy. He's really knowledgeable. But the bottom line is, you know, she was like, can I spray rosemary oil or whatever? And I said, you know, to my knowledge, nothing actually repels them, you know, so yes, they're probably not going to be like hanging out around the dining area so much if those trees are gone, but they're not just going to magically totally go away from your property either. You know, they'll be around.
You know, it's interesting, Margaret, that you mentioned, you know, we don't know what that population is going to be next year. It's kind of a guessing game. Here in central Pennsylvania, it's going to be interesting the next couple months as they send out the survey crews to see what kind of spongy moth issue we're going to have in central Pennsylvania. For those folks that have listened to some of our previous podcasts, I kind of gave periodic updates on what was going on in this area. And over 300,000 acres of state-owned land was sprayed for this spongy moth this year. And that doesn't include what occurred on private land. I mean, you had private landowners that, you know, they're managing for timber or recreation purposes, that they also hired out these aircraft to come in and apply products for these spongy moths. So they went and defoliate, you know, the canopies. So we're kind of have to see how effective that was, see what kind of spread there was. And, you know, usually I think it's like February, sometime in February, they release the numbers and their strategy for the upcoming growing season. The other thing, and I don't know if this is related, I've seen this the past couple of weeks, as I go up and down the valleys here in central Pennsylvania, and you know, we're in kind of in that ridge and valley topography, the hillsides are not looking good in some areas. And I don't think it's early fall color. I think the trees are stressed out, and I need to go up and take a hike. Maybe I can do it on a work week, because I'm investigating and trying to answer a question. But it's just an odd color. It's not a colorful fall color, and I don't know if this is stress related to spongy moth activity, or there's something going on with the climate that we have had. You know, we were really, really dry certain times last year and early part of this season, and we had this excessive rain, and I don't know if the trees are responding differently, but yeah, it's going to be kind of interesting.
Are these mostly deciduous trees that you're seeing?
Yes, deciduous trees.
A lot of oaks.
What's that?
Do you have a lot of oaks?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to, there some oaks are showing some weird symptoms. Of course, the black locust, they're all turned brown because of the locust leaf miner.
Yeah.
But I've noticed some of the cherries are exhibiting some weird symptoms. So I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. Trying to untangle what's causing what, because everything is kind of related, obviously, but these stressors kind of compound and interact with each other. And so a tree that is drought stressed is gonna, you know, maybe be more susceptible to lasting damage from insect feeding, and maybe more susceptible to disease, making more of an impact than it normally would. And then, yeah, to get, that's what we've had out here as well, is really dry periods followed by these really intense rainstorms that the soil just gets saturated, and lots of plants. I've gotten a couple of calls from vegetable growers whose whole fields just seem to wilt because their soil gets so saturated that the plants can't take up any oxygen. And so it looks like they're drought stressed, but they're actually, there's too much water at the root zone, and especially for heavy clay soils. And so, yeah, you know, trying to figure out what's causing what is pretty tricky. And sometimes with trees, right, we don't know until a couple years later.
Right. You know, if they're stressed out, it's not a quick kill.
Right.
It's something that might be down the road. We see that a lot with the landscape industry, and in that, you know, to me, at least me networking with landscape professionals and, you know, their interaction with homeowners and so forth, that the homeowners, the most common problem is planting trees and shrubs too deep. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that quick kill. It's a tree that will limp along for several years and finally succumb to that bad practice.
Yeah. And, yeah, I got Leah Franck sent me some images of a Deborah maple, which is a cultivar of Norway maple. And this tree just looked, you know, the leaves were kind of crispy looking on it already. And she didn't seem to think it had been excessively dry there. So I'm thinking maybe some anthracnose, but these trees had in the past been volcano mulched, and they had tried to stop that practice. And I suggested, you know, if the client can afford it, to have those trees air spaded to see if, you know, maples sort of can't wait to have girdling roots anyhow. And as soon as you start with the deep planting and the volcano mulching, they often develop girdling roots. So I don't know if that could be what's going on with those trees or what. I'd be interested to hear what they find.
Yeah. Sandy, you had also said that you're dealing with lots of drought stress out where you are. What kind of stuff are you seeing?
My best description is a lot of trees just look tired. They just, you know, they're just like, oh, can these leaves drop off and can we start over again? But a lot of yellow leaves dropping off of trees. I was away for a couple of weeks, like the end of August, beginning of September. But since I've been home, we haven't had a drop of rain, and stuff is just real, you know, I can't say I see the soil cracking open. In some places that might be the case, but I just think it's really dry, and especially street trees are really looking sad.
Yeah. Tim, what are you seeing in South Central / East Pennsylvania?
Wherever I am. Huh?
Wherever you are.
Wherever you are.
I do want to compliment you as our, like our host, because, you know, you started this off with, you know, that this was a special edition of the podcast, whereas I look at it as we couldn't find any guests for this week, so we just scraped together and threw us on.
Tim, you're blowing my cover. That's
you did an awesome job.
Extra special episode.
I mean, on the news, we're about 7 inches below normal for precipitation, but we've been able to get just enough, I think, spaced out and short enough intervals that, you know, grass is still green. Like, you know, my yard's still actively growing and hasn't slowed down. Like, you know, a year ago when we were like in that summer into fall drought, which was, you know, really bad. And trees look fairly decent. I mean, as Sandy described them as tired. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some. And I think those were more ones in like the harshest planting environments, like the parking islands and things like that, where, you know, that combination of stressors really just are taking them out. But for the most part, I look at it, it's a pretty decent, like late summer into fall. It seems like the western part of the state is dealing with the lanternfly populations that lots of the other parts have in the last, you know, 5 to 8 years. And it's not bad, like, you know, in my area. I've rarely seen an adult, you know, since they came out, which, as far as the nuisance factor, and, you know, for any of the vineyards in my area, you know, that's fantastic if you're a landscape slash tree care company who, you know, in the last few years that had become part of your business, is to, you know, you're getting lots of extra revenue from treating for lantern flies, and now you're going to be hurting. So hopefully they didn't budget in like a lot of, you know, profit for the year was all the lantern fly treatments, because that just did not happen. Hmm. But it's,
and we got people out here who are definitely cashing in on that.
Yeah, and you know, and
go for it.
If the market's there and you're using the right material and doing the right thing, that's fine. I mean, I think the one issue that we discussed yesterday at a pest walk I was involved with was, you know, treating for pretty much any pest, but we can use like lantern fly as a model, where you are going to try to, you know, you're targeting larger size plant material, trees, and you wanted to use a systemic, is because of the lack of precipitation through lots of the growing season, you know, early, then some parts of the state, even in the middle of the summer, and now again, like late summer, is, you know, particularly if you're using imidacloprid, is like,
right,
getting that stuff up into the tree so it's actually effective when whatever life stage you were trying to target, which now would be adults. Like if you're trying to put systemics on now, to me it's way too late. You're not going to, stuff's not going to move.
Yeah, that's so, an important material for hemlock woolly adelgid too. So
right, so it's going back to like, you know, just your, and tied in just like sound IPM practices, is, you know, what are your control options? What's your target pest? And then what's the environment? You know, whether that's the environmental conditions of, you know, drought or heat, plus just, you know, where's the plant located? You know, like the examples with those walnuts at that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if like this year wasn't so bad, she could have went with like some systemics for like next year, but you know, you couldn't wait. Obviously it wasn't going to be able to go in there and spray this year. You know, the trees are probably too big, and you know, you're soaking areas you don't want to hit with, you know, your application. So
right, that was a very you know, kind of a tricky situation, you know, for her to try
definitely
figure out. And I think, you know, when I talk to people who are like, right now we have like people who aren't plant people or bug people are hysterical about the spotted lantern flies. And they're like, what can I do to make them go away? And I'm like, you know, we can kill them by the thousands, and a thousand more are going to come onto that tree. It's, you know, even if you treat the tree, you're, you know, and they feed on it and die, that's not going to keep other ones from coming in and feeding on that same tree. So,
And
now with that new information that came out from the university researchers, that we're not seeing a lot of mortality, you know, with the hardwoods, that, you know, I'm trying to get people to back off of treating and maybe really prioritize, like, you know, is this a tree that's hanging over a playground or, you know, someplace where people congregate, where you're going to have that nuisance factor with all the honeydew? Maybe you want to treat that tree on the hope that if they die before they're feeding on that tree for any length of time, that can minimize some of the nuisance.
Yeah. And it's easy for me to say what I'm going to say, because I don't run a business, but
right.
One, you know, yes. You know, when you've been able to build in a lot of lantern fly applications, you know, and they're helping your bottom line, and then they're gone, you know, that's significant loss of revenue. But it's, and you know, again, we're using lantern fly as a model because we're talking about it, that, you know, it's a good chance for landscape tree care professionals to like just talk with whoever their clients are and try to get through to them and educate them. And these would be the people who are really just, you know, freaked out by lantern flies. You know, there are people who just don't like insects. I get it. Mm-hmm. You know,
mm-hmm. And they're big.
They're big and colorful and clumsy flyers when they're down low. So they're banging into you and landing on you. And, you know, that, you know, might cause some concern, but it's trying to get through to them that, you know, they're not going to bite you. They're not going to sting you, and probably not going to damage any plants that you have. And, you know, they're around in significant numbers if you have them, you know, for like, you know, a month and a half or so, and then they're gone. And, you know, Tom's going to talk about, you know, some stinging insects that are common now. And yes, if you're interacting with them and you, you know, you get on the wrong side and agitate them, you know, even if they're not protecting their, you know, hive, you know, it's going to be an unpleasant experience for you. But like lanternflies, there are so many other greater problems in the world that, you know, you just tolerate them and let them go. So,
okay. So we're in kind of agreement that maybe we need not be worried about the spotted lanternfly that much, right?
Right.
So a couple of weeks ago, we had a green industry kind of team meeting, and Ruth Benner gave us a report on her trip out of Canada. And she talked about, I think it was she visited a cemetery, and she noticed these shrubs that were just kind of totally browned out in early mid-August, which they shouldn't have been. And she stopped and looked at them, and they were boxwoods. And it was the boxwood tree moth. So is that an insect that we as educators or the green industry should be worried about more so than something like the spotted lanternfly?
The Department of the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture did send out an alert. I don't know if everybody would have gotten it. I think I got it because I'm here in Western Pennsylvania, because in Southern Ohio, they have discovered an established population of those caterpillars. So, yeah, and actually I have talked about it at my meetings in the past, just, you know, kind of an awareness thing. And, you know, boxwoods really took a hit from last winter. I think that brutal cold weather we had right before Christmas, before stuff was really truly hardened off, did a big number on them, especially if they're sheared boxwood and they got sheared late in the season, they seem to really suffer. So I was at University of Pittsburgh campus, and they have a pair of steps and a boxwood hedge on either side of these steps, and they both look pretty bad. But the one had all this webbing on it, and that made my antenna go up, and I was really going through there looking for those caterpillars, and I did not find them. They had a very heavy infestation of boxwood spider mites, but the webbing was too coarse for that. So
for the box tree moth. For the mites.
I think it would have been appropriate for the caterpillars. So I really went through there with a fine tooth comb and couldn't find any evidence. I mean, there's damage to them, but it looked more like the winter injury. And I submitted samples up to the plant disease clinic, and they came back positive for Volutella. But they and the mites, and they sent some of the samples over to Michael Scavarla, but. And no evidence of those caterpillars, but I sure was looking because all the webbing, and I still don't know what caused the webbing. I got to be honest with you.
Okay. Well, I do think, you know, from some of the pictures that Ruth shared with the team on this box tree moth, that is an insect that if it comes into Pennsylvania, I think there's going to be a great concern. I don't think this one's going to be a nuisance pest to the landscape industry.
No. And, you know, for boxwood growers, and so many of us, so many companies use boxwoods extensively in landscapes because the deer leave them alone. And plus, they just serve a really good purpose in a landscape. So I think this is definitely one that we ought to have on people's radar, just even from like making them aware so that if they see weird stuff on one of their customers' properties, they can say, hey, Sandy, when you come over here and take a look at this. You know.
I think Michael Scavarla, who runs Penn State's insect clinic, produced a fact sheet on that. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay. So for anyone that's listening, that might be a good resource and maybe a winter training session for the employees.
Yep. Good plan.
So Margaret, go ahead, Tim.
I think it's still important to also be on the lookout for boxwood blight too.
I haven't heard
anything from PDA this year as to whether they had any incidents like in a landscape. I mean, that stuff's kept kind of quiet as far as whether it's in production or landscape, and I haven't heard anything, but.
No, that's a good, that was a, really heightened concern a few years back, but that seems to have quieted down a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, I was on a landscape. A contractor asked me to go to several properties with him to examine the boxwoods, and most of them look like Volutella to me. But we were on one property, you know, because the big thing with boxwood blight is it defoliates them. You know, with Volutella, the dead leaves tend to stick on those twigs. You could see those cankers on the stems.
Oh, yeah.
So I had him send some samples up to Sarah May, And, you know, I said, you know, give her a heads up that you think this is boxwood blight so that she's aware when she opens that sample. And she contacted PDA. So as far as I know, PDA was going to do a follow-up visit to this property.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to start. And again, this is, you know, more of a, this is a personal, not a professional opinion. When it comes, you know, boxwood, you know, the two more exotic pests that it has, and then throwing, you know, boxwood leaf miner and the spider mites and volutella. I tell them, I go, if you're putting those sort of, you know, broadleaf, but small leaf evergreens into a property, I go, I would also start considering like some of the Japanese hollies. I mean, they're not perfect replacements, or inkberry holly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of those newer cultivars of inkberry, they look pretty nice. You know, when you,
yeah, it's just a, but it's a neat plant.
Yeah. And you know, I wish I had a place. There's no place at my office for anything. I would like to trial some of those. Because
some of the inkberries or Japanese?
Some of the new inkberries.
Yeah.
Because I've heard some real negative stuff about them.
Okay.
But, you know, it's anecdotal. It's not no research-based anything. And, you know, I don't know if Casey Sklar would be interested in doing some kind of trial up at the Arboretum or something just to, you know.
They might not have the room, but you know, the Hort farm, Penn State's horticulture farm, they've got a lot of land. That might be something to look at. I know when the inkberry kind of made a splash many, many years ago, you know, the problem was just the lower canopy, just kind of thinned out, the legginess.
Yep. Yep.
And so they really did a lot of breeding work on that to try to maybe get that out of the system. So,
And some of those really dwarf ones that they've introduced look pretty much like boxwood to me.
Yeah, I agree.
Perform as advertised, they would be great.
Yeah.
But I have heard of some issues with them.
Okay.
It's all anecdotal. So I don't want to slam them because I think, you know, we need to be looking at alternatives for boxwood because between the things Tim mentioned and if that caterpillar gets a foothold, you know, boxwood's going to become really challenging. Yep.
It already is
challenging. It'll be more challenging.
Not even, beyond home landscapes, but I think of all of the formal gardens at botanical gardens and public gardens that utilize so much boxwood to get really clean lines. And that's...
And, you know, this caterpillar has ravaged Europe.
Yeah.
And so those classic gardens that had all that boxwood in them, the boxwood's not looking too swift.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that seems to be what happens when we rely a little too heavily on one plant.
Diversity.
All right. So we've been to three areas of the state, and for folks listening, it sounds kind of doom and gloom. So Margaret, your end of the state.
Everything's great.
Do you have some good news for us somewhere in Pennsylvania?
Well, we don't have a lot of spotted lanternflies, so that's good. I was saying I probably see maybe one a day.
Okay.
And so there's certainly, you know, pretty low populations here. We have also dealt with some extended drought periods from the spring and into the summer a little bit. And then what's really been problematic, we've been getting rain, but a lot of it has just come, kind of all at once and caused flooding. And I had mentioned soil saturation before. Some of you may have heard there was some pretty catastrophic flooding in Bucks County. Some people passed away while they were driving on the road. And we living here in Philly, we get maybe one alert per week of flood watch. You know, we get some tornado watches. You had asked me not to talk doom and gloom, but it just
that's
seems
what makes
like
news, right?
It just seems like there's been a lot of extremes as far as precipitation is concerned. And I think that those storms are more intense, than in the past. And so I work with cut flower growers as well, and they have a lot of issues with those heavy storms because their crops are upright and they're delicate and really high value crops in a small area. And so if one really bad you know, wind and rainstorm comes through and knocks down a grower's dahlias, you know, that could be a lot of money lost for that season. So seeing some of that, I have been helping out with some pest walks around this part of the state in the last couple of weeks, and seeing a lot of bacterial leaf scorch on oak, which is nothing new. In this part of Pennsylvania, it's hard to walk by red oaks without seeing some bacterial leaf scorch. And even we went to a Phillies game last week or 2 weeks ago, and as we were walking towards Citizens Bank Park, it's all oak tree, like these little oak trees that they've planted along the parking lot, and they all have bacterial leaf scorch. And so it's just kind of ubiquitous here, and you know, hopefully they hang on and for a while longer. But yeah, and I have an eye out for invasive plants because I teach invasive plant ID and management, and always looking at what interesting weeds and things are growing in the landscape and how that corresponds to the weather we're having. And definitely, I mean, so much crabgrass right now. I think that is the big winner of this season. And a lot of pokeweed. Do you guys have pokeweed out by you?
Oh,
so
yeah.
a couple people at pest walks that I've been to, I've been bringing some samples for ID practice and discussion. And pokeweed's a native plant, but it is it can be a very aggressive spreader and has root system that makes it really hard to get rid of once it's established. And then these really juicy berries that form, these fruits that birds really like, evidently. And my thought, and we've been seeing so much pokeweed this year, and one of my thoughts is, you know, that taproot allows it to withstand drought conditions really well. And also, we had all that drought last summer, and those berries, you know, have a lot of water in them. And so I'm thinking birds were just kind of going crazy and eating them and dispersing them all over the place. So those are my ecological theories.
And you mentioned pokeweed. I have a couple of pokeweeds in the garden, and I just cut them down year after year. And the other day, well, a couple of weeks ago, I got so annoyed with cutting them down that I dug them up, and I had to get my iron bar.
The root system is crazy.
Oh my God. I finally got removed it. You know, this was what Margaret was saying, this extensive root system. I mean, it was like this massive, like tuber like structure. Yeah. I mean, it was several pounds, if not eight or nine pounds. And so that's what you get for letting pokeweed go year after year, that if you can kind of get it early on and, you know, dig up that little root structure, but it just gets larger and larger and almost unmanageable.
Yeah. One thing I have noticed, because I deal with it in my own yard, and I had let a couple of them develop those incredible rhizome-like structures. If you whisper the word glyphosate to pokeweed, it dies.
Oh, okay. So pretty effective on it.
It's very effective on it.
Doing a kind of cut it down and then paint a little herbicide on the cut surface
could probably work too. Yep.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Yeah, interesting. It is a I was reading about it. It's all the plant parts are toxic to ingest, but apparently there are ways to prepare the root and the different plant parts to be safe for consumption, although we're not advocating that.
No.
But it does have a lot of cultural and medicinal values that that a lot of our native plants do, but can certainly, I mean, it can grow up to 9 feet tall and just be a big pain in the landscape. And so, seeing a lot of that.
You mentioned that toxicity. I had a call several years ago. Someone was rooting around in their garden and they thought it was, I don't know if it was a potato or a turnip or what they thought it was, but they thought it was edible. And they cooked it up somehow. Oh, they made it into a smoothie. They made that root structure into a smoothie and ended up in the hospital. I mean, the hospital called and, you know, they were sent pictures of this root. And I said, well, from the pictures, that appears to be, you know, I didn't have it in my physical presence. So, you know, I hedged a little bit, but it appeared to be a pokeweed root mass. Wow. So, yes, very toxic.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like foraging has become a thing.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, it's one thing if you want to forage, but go out with knowledgeable people. Don't just
definitely
go out there and start munching on something you don't know what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Make sure you know how to identify things. And oftentimes there are different preparations that you have to do
exactly.
before something becomes edible. So, yeah. I mean, pokeweed berries look very delicious. Appetizing.
Yeah,
gotta be so careful out there.
I was at a mushroom club meeting and the one woman had a t-shirt on that said, every mushroom is edible, sometimes only once.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. We get those at least in my extension office about once or twice a year, we get those calls about mushrooms and mm-hmm. I say, nope.
Not I did.
Fortunately, we have the Western Pennsylvania Mushroom Club. And they're really knowledgeable. And I usually say, you know what, contact them.
Oh, yeah, right. I send
them
elsewhere.
They know their stuff. Yeah.
I point them to some reference material, things like that. But I'm not going to answer whether something is edible or not edible. That's too dangerous. And I'm not as versed in it as some of these other experts anyways.
No, I am not either. And I like mushrooms a little bit. I'm not, I'm not out there foraging. And I just developed a new talk on wood decay fungi in trees. Mm. And apparently some of those fruiting structures are indeed edible. And according to people who like that sort of thing are delicious. And, you know, some of the questions that people were asking me when I was going through this talk, I was like, I cannot advise you on whether you should eat this or not. Fine.
Yeah.
You know, go to the Western Pennsylvania Mushroom Club. They'll tell you.
Mm. Yeah. I did get an interesting email, kind of an unassuming email a couple months ago from a school district. And they said with some urgency in the text of the email, you know, our facilities person thinks there's Eastern hemlock growing in the schoolyard. Can you take a look at these pictures? And I was like, that does not look like Eastern hemlock. And then I realized what they meant was
poison
hemlock. And it absolutely was. And there was all this poison hemlock growing adjacent to the playground of the school. And that's another plant that we've seen just kind of populations just kind of skyrocketing in the last years. And I'm not really sure why, but that can be definitely causes contact dermatitis, definitely has toxicity if it's ingested. It's a big problem in pastures for livestock and animals. That's a highly toxic plant as well. So knowing how to identify that one is good. If you work in roadside settings or anything where it's a little swampy or it looks quite similar to Queen Anne's lace. It's got those purple splotches on the stem, which is a good way to identify a kind of a caution coloration on the stem that says don't eat me. But I was like, these are not Eastern hemlocks. What are they talking about? I was prepared to send
look
them fact sheets about woolly adelgid and all this stuff. So Tom, you had mentioned earlier that you had a client with some issues with European hornets.
Oh yeah. So I got a call from an individual and they wanted some general information on European hornet and more or less how to control it. And I'm not sure he was satisfied with some of the answers, but his issue was that they over the years, they have destroyed his lilacs. And with these European hornets, what they'll do is they'll remove the bark on lilacs and other trees, but the preferred host or feeding is on these lilacs, and they take this bark back and, you know, like other hornets, they basically make paper. They chew this material up, mix it with saliva, their enzymes, and they use it to create or build their paper nests. And so he wanted to know, you know, what you can do to deter hornet activity. And then the other question he had was that they killed all his lilacs and now they're moving to the apples, and not so much the apple trees, but the apple itself. And they're of course on that, just like any hornet, yellow jacket, that, you know, they're going after that nectar source, that sugar. So, but yeah, you know, and I was thinking about it, European hornet and lilacs. So, you know, why is the lilac the preferred species? And the only thing I could think of, I didn't look this up, but I think at least the common lilac, I don't know about all the species of lilacs, but common lilac is not native to the U.S. I think that's from Europe. So the European hornet, I assume European hornet's from Europe. So I guess maybe those two have a kind of a somewhat intimate relationship. But I thought that was kind of interesting on, you know, the call. I've heard about that being an issue, but I've never really run across it until this individual was asking some questions.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it bad enough to kill plants. I mean, I've seen some, and they'll hit viburnum sometimes too. But yeah, that'd be cool. Did he send you any pictures?
No, he didn't. He didn't send me any pictures. One of the questions, we were talking and conversing, and he wanted to know if you can follow them back to the hive. And that's a good question. I don't know. I know with honeybees, there's a practice called bee lining. And so what you would do is you'd get a couple of honeybees in a container or whatever, and then let them out one at a time. And you would follow that bee out of that container and then as far as you can go until you lose sight of it. And wherever you lose sight of it, then you let the next honeybee out, and then you would follow that. And eventually it would take you to their home. And they, people would use this to try to find those honeybee hives out in the forest, you know, those hollowed out tree trunks to get eventually honey. So I don't know if that's something that you could do with a European hornet. I mean, if his trees were that valuable, you know, with the Asian giant hornet, which was over in the state of Washington, to track those hornets, they captured a couple of them. But instead of just kind of beelining them just visually, they tagged them with, I guess, you know, some sort of microchip or something so that they could follow it back to the hive and the nest. And they eliminated those. So maybe in the future, once technology comes down and costs, maybe they could do that with the European hornet, is track them, tag them and track them.
And you nailed it, Tom, as far as where Syringa vulgaris is native. According to the Missouri Botanic Garden, it's native to open woodlands, rocky hills, and scrubby areas in southeastern Europe.
Okay. Yeah, so for some reason, I guess that European hornet likes that. But as Tim mentioned, and when... I think you said viburnum, so I guess maybe what's available.
Well, they say you learn something new every day, and that little beeline trick I'd never heard of.
So no, me either. That's really interesting. Yeah,
I guess that's, you know, when bees were much more plentiful and out in the wooded areas, it's just a good way to get some free honey. Mm-hmm. It's a little harder to do something like that now. But you know, we're talking about some of these stinging insects. You know, in one of our team meetings the other day, our individual that runs the insect clinic, Michael Scrivala, he had talked about the what's the other hornet that's just made its way into the United States? Yeah, the yellow-legged hornet. And that was only, I think he said that was in Georgia that they found it.
I can't remember. The southern states.
Southern states. And so it's kind of similar to, I guess, this Asian giant hornet. And, you know, it's a kind of a heightened concern. And, you know, the big concern with the Asian and I guess this yellow-legged hornet is mostly with the honeybee industry, because they'll feed upon the European honeybee. I mean, I don't know much about the yellow-legged, but I've seen some videos of this Asian giant hornet, which some people call the murder hornet. And it can decimate a honeybee population quickly. I mean, they just tear into it.
But what's the status? So the yellow-legged hornet, though, it's only been identified down south. It has not been identified in Pennsylvania. I know that we did get a couple of questions about it, because I think it came, there was a news program similar to what happened with the Asian giant hornet, where it was all over the news, and the something in that news report said, if you see this, you know, make sure to report it to your local extension office or something. And so I think that we were talking before about how when the Asian giant hornet craze was really at its height, I at that point was working in New Jersey working more on the consumer side of horticulture, so fielding phone calls from homeowners. And we got so many calls saying, I found the first Asian murder hornet in New Jersey. And they were 90% European hornets when they sent in the photo, 10% cicada killers, which are also active in the summertime and are also very large and look intimidating. But I am sure that our friend Michael has gotten quite a few questions about large wasps that have been seen out in the landscape. But good to know that it is not in Pennsylvania at this time.
I'm pretty sure he talked about that, fielding a lot of calls and looking at a lot of samples.
Yeah. Well, great. So I think it's about time to wrap up. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's always great to have some time to just chat about what's happening around the state. I think, as Tim mentioned, sometimes these episodes arise because we can't find a guest to come on. But I do think we all, you know, we're out in the field and seeing interesting stuff and hearing interesting things. And I always am grateful for the chance to chat with colleagues about all this stuff. We can nerd out about all the plant stuff and insect stuff that we're seeing. So usually we end the episode asking our guests what they do outside of work. We're going to do a special fall edition because it is fall starting tomorrow. And we're going to go around and say what our favorite fall activity is. So Sandy, let's start with you. What's your favorite activity for fall, or what's something you're really looking forward to in this season?
Phantom Fest at Kennywood Park, which is it's our amusement park. It's actually sort of famous. Probably out in Philadelphia, you don't hear about it so much, but it's kind of famous. It's a very long established place, and they have started doing this Halloween themed Phantom Fest, and they have a roller coaster called the Steel Phantom. And that's one of those crazy corkscrew roller coasters. So I guess that's why they call it Phantom Fest. But they do, they have like mist going in the air, fog blowing through the park, and they have certain rides open. They have people with chainsaws and people leap out of quarters at you. And and they have different like spooky places to go through. So I look forward to doing that.
Sandy, do you go on the corkscrew roller coaster?
You know what? I have fused discs in my neck. I can't tolerate that. Mm-hmm. I do go on the Thunderbolt, though, which is
an old wooden
coaster. I can still ride that.
Oh, nice. That sounds so fun. Tim, what about you?
I don't think I have like one favorite thing. I really like fall for being outside. You know, you can get, fairly mild, like daytime temperatures, and then, you know, it cools off so much at night. And, you know, summer is so colorful, with the various flowering plants and foliage, but, you know, you just get that complete change with, you know, from going from so much green to all the oranges, yellows, reds, combinations. And to me, like particularly when you're in the woods, fall just has that smell. I'm not sure what it is. I'm sure you can trace it to different fungi, bacteria, plant volatiles. I don't know, but it sort of has like this pleasant smell of decay, you know, like a bad smell. And I don't know, like grew up in the woods and I just love, it's my favorite season. I don't have a favorite, I guess, specific thing.
What about you, Tom?
Well, I kind of mimicking a little bit what the previous two said. One, Sandy on the Thunderbolt. I grew up outside of Pittsburgh and made regular treks down to Kennywood, and the Thunderbolt was always, you know, kind of the highlight of the excursion. So, yeah. And then the other thing is kind of what Tim said there. You know, we have four seasons, and my favorite is fall, and I don't think it's just one thing. It's just being outside and not sweating. And just being oppressed by the humidity and this and that. And I live in central Pennsylvania, surrounded by state forests. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'll go on bike rides and hikes and just kind of get lost, you know, just mentally get lost in the outside environment, the natural world. And that's fun.
Mm. Wow.
What about you,
Margaret? How about you, Margaret?
Yeah, well, I had mentioned before we started recording that I recently moved with my partner to a new little house in South Philly. And this is the first apartment I've had where we have a little outdoor space. And so we have a little tiny patio in the back of the house that it's kind of abuts all of the other patios of our neighbors. But there's plenty of space out there for container gardens. And so I just went to a couple garden centers as I was driving through Bucks County doing some work and picked up some nice fall annuals. And so I'm just really excited. Obviously, I love gardening, but I've never had the space to do containers at my home before. And so that's what I'm looking forward to the most. Yeah, nice. I got some
awesome. Nice, congratulations. Huge,
thank you. Yeah, big celosias that are really brightly colored, and sweet potato vine, and some marigolds. So it's gonna look nice out there, I think.
Nice.
Yeah.
You need to get a fire pit.
A little fire pit. We're gonna maybe get a little charcoal grill. It's a very small space, so we'll have to see. But yeah, that would be nice. Yeah, well, it's great to catch up with you guys. Thank you so much for being here this afternoon and sharing what you're seeing. And we'll do another check-in podcast episode like this when the seasons change again.
Sounds great.
Sounds good.
Yep.
All right. Take care, guys.
Bye.
You too.